Well, it's great to be with you guys from the Pacific Northwest. I actually was born in eastern New Mexico and lived in Roswell, New Mexico until I was 16. It was there in 1947 that the alien spacecraft crashed. What most people don't realize is that spacecraft left some eggs. And one of them hatched 2 years later, explaining my existence. From Roswell, I moved to Austin, Texas, where I went to high school and college at the University of Texas. And they are currently playing Kansas, I think, and it's being TiVo'd, so you guys don't need to worry about that. I'll watch it later on. Anyone else here got a team you're rooting for today? A football team? We have two football fans here. David Jacobowski, I know you're a football fan. Who are you rooting for today? That'd be the Badgers, right? That's the team? That's the team, right? The team. Who?
Tomorrow.
Oh, there's a team tomorrow you guys root for? When would that be? The Vikings. Gosh, I thought there'd be some Packer fans here. I guess you got a couple. Yeah, okay, the Vikings. Well, I know Scott. If you guys know Scott, where are you? Scott, oh, there he is. Look at him. Guess who he's rooting for? That's his Christmas present. Of course, all men buy themselves a Christmas present. And if it's football season, you got all this football paraphernalia. You don't want to wait till the season's over or almost over to wear it. So, Scott, you look really good in that, huh? Doesn't he? Huh? And I want to thank Scott for pulling this thing together. I spoke at their church back in March. In fact, I actually spoke in their church on my birthday, which was an amazing thing. And I will have to tell you guys, however, I am actually 65 years old today. No, it's not my birthday, but I am 65 years old today. And feel perfectly comfortable to use that. It always works. My grandson says it like this. I'm 8 years old today, but it's not my birthday. I'm trying to teach him that with humor, you kind of have to have a little pause sometime to set up the punchline. So he's been practicing it. You know, he's almost got it down. I've actually had church bands strike up happy birthday. I let them go ahead and do it. If they want to sing happy birthday to me, that's fine. Even though it's technically speaking not my birthday, but I am 65 years old today. I like to brag about my age because I think it serves as an encouragement to men who are younger than me who think, well, if you're 65, you must not be able to think or act or walk or any of those sorts of things. So, you know, and I was inspired by Louis Palau, who was like in his mid-70s. I was sharing the platform with him once and he mentioned that he was 75. And I thought, man, if I look like that when I don't look like that now. He's got a full head of gray hair and anyway, it's great to be with you guys. I'm really honored. I want to mention to you this resource. One of the things that I really hope happens as a result of our time together, in fact, in my opinion, it's the most important thing that will happen, and that is that, you know, as a result of this time together, you guys are going to get together in small groups of 4, 5, 6 guys and take 6 to 8 weeks to actually go through this book. At the end of every chapter, there's discussion questions, so it doesn't require preparation. Just read the chapter and then show up and discuss the questions. And the reason I say that is because it's really in the context of friendships that we as men grow. It's in the context of going through this book together that you will sharpen each other as you talk about these concepts and you challenge each other. So anyway, there are books out there on the table, and Scott is going to be there to receive your credit card or your cash or your check or whatever. We also need some small group facilitators. So if you go to, how many of you guys go to this church? Okay, how many of you guys go to other churches? Oh, wow, that's awesome. What other churches do we have? Cornerstone. Countryside in Maryland. Wow, you came a long ways.
Maryland is 20 miles away.
Okay, funny. All right. No, that's great. So we got Countryside, and we got Crossroads in Pittsville. And what else we got? Crossroads, Countryside, Cornerstone. Who?
LCs?
All the churches start with a C. Listen, man, I was down in West Virginia speaking once, and I asked the men, well, so where's your church? They're like, we go to YLR. I mean, you ever heard a real hillbilly try to talk? They can understand each other. And so I asked him, would you repeat that more slowly? I couldn't understand him. So another guy stood up and said, he lives. And I'm serious. I mean, really. So I got in a cab and I asked the cabbie, I go, so what's a hillbilly? And he goes, these people, you can't understand them when they talk. Fortunately, I could understand him. But anyway, This book, Six Rules Every Man Must Break, is an important book to me. And the reason it's important is because it's a book about the difference between the grace of God and legalism and rigidity. And as men, we always have a tendency to create religion. You know, we follow Christ in the concept of grace, but we have to have some rules and regulations to kind of control it all. And the thing I remind men of is Jesus Christ was killed by religious people because he didn't conform to their man-made rules. Now, he totally submitted to the rules of the Father, the rules of God. He totally obeyed those. It was all these add-on rules. Those are the ones he had a problem with. And so what we want to do is there are certain rules he broke that we need to break if we're going to be devoted followers of Jesus. And that's really what this is about. It's about that kind of a faith that's liberating and empowering. So what I hope is that we will have a couple guys from each of your churches meet with me for about 5 minutes or so after this session so we can talk about these groups. There's only a few rules. There's only 4 little quick rules, you know, in terms of the small group. You can break them if you want. But so I want you to be thinking about if you would be willing to be for 6 to 8 weeks a facilitator for these groups. It just means read the chapter ahead, you know, let the guys know when and where you're going to meet, and then lead them through this. Because listening to me give a talk is nothing like is powerful and transformational in your life as going through this together with a handful of guys. So I really want to encourage you to consider that. And somewhere around here, I hope I have a remote so I can control the slides. I'm such a loser. I actually, is it up there? Oh, there you go. Thanks. I've actually formed an organization called Losers Anonymous. It's for people that are compulsive losers. You know, misplaced things, right? Okay. I didn't know I was a loser until I came home one night. All my family was there. My 3 sons, my wife, couple of my friends, and I sat down, and I thought, obviously, they were waiting for me, and it was kind of like, what's up now? What did they catch me doing? And so I sat down, and my oldest son said, Dad, we all love you, but there's something we think you need to know. And I go, what's that, son? He goes, Dad, you're a loser. So it was an intervention, you know, and I had to come to grip with this fact, and so I actually formed this organization. I bought the domain name. I came up with 12 steps following the AA 12-step program, which I'm sure some of you are probably a part of. Or NA, Narcotics Anonymous, AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, LA, Losers Anonymous. I came up with 12 steps. I lost them. I lost my list. You know, I should have saved it on the computer, but it's frustrating. Anyone else here misplace things? Okay, so we got to cut. Listen, guys, really, serious. We have a program. It's very helpful, and you're going to appreciate it. In fact, I'm going to start off this session by telling you a story about one time when I lost my cool. But first, let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for these guys. I want to thank you for the privilege we have of being together this morning on this beautiful, beautiful fall morning. And I want to pray you would meet us here. I pray that you would be our teacher. You are our master. Be our teacher. I pray, Father, you would help us be the men you want us to be. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So there's 6 rules in this book, but in the time that we have, I'm going to cover 2 of those rules. The rule of restraint, which basically has to do with learning to manage your anger, Jesus would. And then I'm going to give a talk on the rule of never look stupid, because sometimes it's our fear of looking stupid that prevents us from being men of faith. And then I'm going to actually give a talk that's not from it, because I've been reading through the Gospels every month for the last 2.5 years, and it's really impacted my life. So I'd kind of like to tell a story about Jesus, but and I think it'll kind of tie all this together for you. But this is actually a reminder to me of a trip that I made to St. Louis. And flying to St. Louis from Portland, Oregon means getting up very early in the morning for me, catching a plane, flying to Dallas, and then from Dallas a connecting flight to St. Louis. Well, I arrived at the hotel at about 6 p.m. I was very hungry. In fact, I hadn't eaten anything but a protein bar since breakfast. I had a speaking engagement at 7, so I went into a Red Robin restaurant that was actually adjacent to, connected to the hotel. And when I went in, the hostess seated me at a table, and this cute food server with a button of a nose and dark hair and a nice smile came over, and as I was looking at the menu, it was one of those, you know, Red Robin, they've just got a lot of things to choose for. And I asked her, what's the best meat item? Now, I asked her this question because my doctor had recently told me that my triglycerides were high and I needed to go on a more high-protein diet. And so I was going on this high-protein diet, so I asked her, what's the best meat item on the menu? And she lifted her nose in the air and said, I don't know, I'm a vegetarian. Now, you have to understand, my blood sugar was low, okay? And I was hungry. And there was, I don't have an issue with people that prefer eating dead plants to dead animals, okay? I do not have an issue with that, you know? My friend here from India, there's phenomenal vegetarian food in India, is there not? It's delicious. I've been many trips to India. I love vegetarian food. I say all that just to let you know, this was not a prejudicial statement. What really annoyed me, though, was that the way she lifted her nose and talked in kind of a nasal tone gave me the feeling she believed she was spiritually superior to me because she was a vegetarian and I was a carnivore. And so I asked her a very simple question. I said, how are you able to eat plants with a clear conscience? And she said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, aren't you aware there's now scientific evidence that proves without a question that all plant life exists on a conscious level? Plants feel pain. And she said, oh, that's absolutely stupid. That's ridiculous. And I said, oh, you think so? Go to plantscream.com. You can hear a streaming audio of a wheat field crying out in agony as it's being harvested. She goes, oh, that's the most stupid thing I ever heard. And I go, well, you may think so, but it's actually true. And I said, and I said, I just don't understand how you can eat a potato knowing that when that potato was pulled out of the ground, he left Mrs. Potato and Junior Potato there in the ground, fatherless. I just, where's the compassion? Where's the sensitivity? And she said, well, how can you eat a steak? And I said, well, you know, that does bother me. I mean, I'm eating a dead cow. But the good news is that one dead cow will feed many, many, many people, whereas what? One loaf of bread required how many hundreds of wheat people to be slaughtered for a loaf of bread that will basically feed one person. And I said, now I will say this. It bothers me when I think about how many millions of grass people that cow consumed, but that's on his conscience, not mine. There was a food server in training that was kind of listening to us go back and forth like this. And all of a sudden she looks to him, hoping he'll throw her a lifeline. She turns to him and goes, that is just the dumbest thing I've ever heard, isn't it? And he looks at me and goes, no, it's not. It's all true. I've been to the website. You should check it out. So she stomped off and he and I high-fived. Now, I use that as an illustration how easy it is. You know, we can walk into a restaurant feeling like, you know, everything's under control and we're being cool. You know, we know that we're hungry. And, of course, you know, low blood sugar and being hungry can cause, you know, most people to be a tad bit, you know, less patient than they might be in other circumstances. And I have to admit, when I get angry, sometimes I'll use sarcasm rather than, you know, yelling and screaming and throwing things and shooting guns and throwing knives and all that sort of stuff. I'll use sarcasm. And I have to say that perhaps my response in the situation was, okay, it was inappropriate, all right? It just shows how quickly we can go from being calm to kind of losing our cool. And what I want to talk about today is however it is that you express your anger. And by the way, telling a man not to get angry is about as effective as telling a woman not to be emotional. Okay? Try it. You married? When your wife's getting upset next time, say, don't be so emotional. See how that goes over. That's going to go over just about as well when she says, you don't get mad. You see, anger is the primary emotion men use to express themselves. Women use the whole gauntlet, the whole gamut of emotions, but not men. You know, we're angry or we're not angry. That's kind of it. Angry, not angry. That's it. That's the two, you know, maybe you've seen, you know, a woman's mind, and it's like the cockpit of the space shuttle with all these dials and switches and stuff. You know, mind of a man, it just is an on and off switch, right? How a woman shops, and it's this maze. And for a guy, it's just a straight shot right through the store, okay? We are wired very different than women, and anger is part of the deal that we deal with. And so this morning, you're going to discover why it is okay to break the rule of restraint and lose your cool. Because see what we're told? Because anger is as dangerous as live ammunition thrown into a fire. Uncontrolled anger. It could be very dangerous. And all of us have said and done things when we were angry that we wish we could undo, reverse the tape, or delete it. Isn't that right? We've all done that. Hey, every man in some way you know, battles with controlling and expressing anger in a healthy way. I've got another book called When Good Men Get Angry. It's out there on the table. I'm actually teaching through it to about 50 to 80 guys at the church that I attend. And we express anger in a whole lot of different sorts of ways. But what we're oftentimes told in the church is just don't get mad. Just don't get angry. All anger is a sin. Well, if all anger, we'll get into this. I'm getting ahead of myself. So anger then is an intense emotional state induced by displeasure. Now you know what it is. An intense emotional state induced by displeasure. For some reason, that definition leaves me wanting more. It doesn't quite seem to capture. I think they need a picture, you know, of someone losing their cool. Now, it's triggered by an event and it involves the entire man. When you get angry, do you know your blood pressure rises? When you get angry, your eyes dilate, your heart rate increases. In other words, when you get angry, you're ready to fight or flee. Because that's what it is. It's the body's natural response to a perceived threat. You know, so all this is happening in my body in order to prepare me to be able to take on an adversary, or if I feel I can't beat that adversary, to run away as fast as I can. That's what anger is about. And the problem is oftentimes we get mad at perceived threats rather than real threats. In fact, most of the time when we're angry, there really isn't any danger sitting out there. Where does it come from? It actually flows from God's holiness and love. Here's an amazing statistic. The word anger is used 455 times in the Old Testament. Now, some people will say all anger is a sin. Well, if all anger is a sin, then why is it in 375 of those 455 instances, God is the one who's angry? Well, we know God can't sin, and if God can't sin, and yet 375 times in the Old Testament God is angry, then anger itself must not be a sin. So the issue is not, is anger a sin or not? The question is, anger is immoral. It's how I process and express it that can be sinful and damaging. So, anger is God's logical response to injustice or unrighteousness. So when God sees something that's unjust or unrighteous, He responds with anger. Now, because we are made in the image of God, when we see something that is unjust, unrighteous, dishonest, it triggers anger inside of us too. Because we're made in the image of God. That's the way that it affects us. It's the emotion that arises when we encounter something we perceive to be wrong. So what makes men mad? Well, I surveyed about 5,000 guys, and a lot of them responded, and I found out the sorts of things that make men mad. For instance, number 5, personal failings. Every man in this room gets mad at himself because he does the same stupid thing over and over and over again, right? I mean, haven't you said that to yourself? When am I going to learn? Why do I keep doing the same stupid thing over and over? And if you're married, your wife reminds you of this. Why do you keep doing the same stupid thing over and over, huh? You know, why don't you learn? Am I right? That's number 5 on the list. Number 4 is other drivers. I got some interesting responses to this one. One guy wrote in there, he says, normally I'm as meek and mild as Clark Kent, but you put me behind the wheel of a 4,000-pound pickup, and he goes, I'm a wild and dangerous man. Do not get in the passing lane and go slow. Other drivers. But I think other drivers really subordinates itself to another reason, which we're going to get to when we get to the top of the list. Dishonesty. We don't like being lied to. We do not like being lied to. If someone is telling us something and we find out later on that they were intentionally lying to us, now we'll be tolerant. They just didn't know. You know, we want to give people the benefit of the doubt, but if we find out we've been lied to, it's going to make us angry. Number 2, injustice. If we feel we're treated unfairly, or if we see someone we care for treated unfairly, the response we're going to have is anger. You know, if someone else gets a promotion that you know you deserve, it's going to probably make you angry. If you see someone treating your wife or one of your kids unjustly, unfairly, you're going to get angry, and you're going to want to use that anger to defend them. But the number 1 reason I believe that men get angry is because of disrespect. In fact, I would go so far as to say that dishonesty is a form of disrespect. If someone lies for you, are they being respectful or disrespectful? Of course. If someone is in the passing lane, which is your lane, and they're going the speed limit instead of going over the speed limit, isn't that being disrespectful, the fact that you own that lane? Yes or no? We kind of feel that way, don't we? I mean, we know technically we don't own it. But we also feel like the guy that's going 55 miles an hour in a 65 mile an hour speed zone and slowing down all the traffic so it looks like, you know, he's the leader in a parade and you're kind of like in a hurry. He's being disrespectful of all these people. I asked my wife once, why do you get in the passing lane and go the speed limit? She said, well, to help everyone else obey the law. She didn't really say that, but I wonder about it sometimes. You know, she just gets distracted. Those are the sorts of things that trigger anger inside of us. So, raises the question, how can we lose our cool without losing control? I want to go to James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20 to answer that question. James says this. He says, this you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Now, when we unpack this little passage, we're going to find into some insight that's going to help us be able to, you know, break the rule of self-restraint, that is to lose our cool without losing control, which is what we want to be able to do. We do that first by learning to listen. We often get mad about perceived wrongs, but God never does. Now, let me say to you, if you get nothing else out of this session but this right here, it will enable you to better manage your anger. By simply asking the question, was it a real wrong or a perceived wrong? Every parent in this room, every dad in this room, at one time or another, if you've got kids, well, if you're a parent, you have kids, you have corrected them for something you thought they did wrong, which you later found out they didn't. A perceived wrong. Every one of us has had someone get mad at us for something they thought we did that we didn't do. They thought that we were the one cutting them off. But in fact, they were just going too slow. Wait, no, that's not exactly a good illustration. But you get the idea. If you can begin to ask yourself the question, is it a wrong, a real wrong, or a perceived wrong? Let me give you an example. I used to work out at this gym, and there was a sign in the gym that said, when crowded, don't stay at the machine. Don't just, you know, camp on a machine if other people are waiting to use it. Well, I was in the gym, and it was a fairly busy day. And there was this guy, I think it was probably his first time there, you know, he had on like spandex shorts and a t-shirt that said what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and he had an afro and a headband around it, and socks pulled up to his knees, and tennis shoes. And he was lifting weights on the bench press machine, and when he finished, there's this big guy, I mean big guy, like a rhino, standing over the machine, kind of looking down at him with a scowl on his face. And the guy finishes and starts to get him and says, hey, man, that's my machine. You interrupted my workout. And, I mean, this was one of these big, big men, right? The other guy was muscular, but more of a lean, wiry kind of muscular. And he looks at Bevo or Rhino or whatever this behemoth of a man was, and he goes, hey, man, he goes, there's a machine right there, use it. Except he was looking up like, there's a machine right there, use it. And I felt like saying, yeah, man, didn't you see the sign over there? Hey, he got up and he moved. You can't camp on this machine. But you know, like when a guy weighs 280, 290, all muscle, I'm just going to kind of stand back and watch and see how this thing works itself out. But let me ask you this question, because it's one I asked myself, because I was actually writing the book at the time it happened. Did that guy with the what stays in happens in Vegas stays in Vegas t-shirt, tie-dye t-shirt, did he intend to disrespect Bevo? No, he did not. He just wanted to work out. He didn't realize the guy somehow obtained ownership of that particular bench. He didn't know that. He was just trying to get his workout done. So that man was angry about a perceived injustice or wrong or act of disrespect that was committed against him when there was no act of disrespect. I've come up with what I call the 80-20 rule. 20% of what triggers our anger is what just happened. 80% is all the stuff in the past that we've never processed, that we're still mad about. This is when you're at work and things are going bad. You lose a sale, someone disrespects you, the boss gets mad at you. It's one of those miserable days at work, right? And when you get home, you specifically told your son to leave his bike in the garage and not in the driveway so he doesn't get run over and stolen. And there's his bike. Now, normally, on a healthy, good day, you just put his bike in the garage. You go and say, son, remember to put your bike in the garage. And that's when he would inform you, oh, I'm not the one that left it there. You know, Sue, his sister, she took it for a ride. Well, I didn't know Sue rode your bike. Yeah, she wants to ride a bigger bike, and so she did it. She forgot it, Dad. You know, say something to her. Now, if it was a bad day, you're bringing the 80 with you. And you see that bike there, and that triggers not just the 20, but the 80. And all of a sudden, man, you get that bike, you grab that thing, and then you grab your son. I told you to keep that bicycle. And your son starts to give his explanation. And you realize that you kind of misjudged the situation. You were angry about a perceived act of disobedience and disrespect rather than the real thing. And I'm here to say, you, if you would begin to ask yourself in the future, when you feel that anger rising, is it a real act of disrespect or is it just a perception? God never gets mad about perceived acts of disrespect. If God gets mad, that's because someone did something they weren't supposed to do, and they dishonored him, they disrespected him. Jesus was 30 when he first cleansed the temple. Now think about that. The beginning and the end of his ministry, he goes into the temple, he sees the disrespect being shown his father, and he cleans the thing out, right? But we know that he was 30 years old when he first entered the temple. But we know every year at Passover, his family probably went to Jerusalem and he saw what was happening in the temple. He saw all the money changers ripping off people by charging these crazy interest rates. He saw sick cows being sold as healthy cows. He saw these sellers charging too much for these animals to be sacrificed. And so he just ran them all off, man. He made a whip out of threaded together some leather straps and made a whip and ran them over and turned over their tables. It's interesting, however, he didn't let the birds free, because all the animals could be captured and brought back. But if he let the birds up free, they might never come back. So even though he was expressing his anger, he was expressing it with some restraint. I'm convinced that he processed what he saw in the temple for years and decided what he was going to do to show his unhappiness with the disrespect being shown his father. The thing is, we need to process our anger. We need to think about it before we act. We need to learn to listen. And that's how we find out, is it real disrespect or a perception of disrespect? Are we being lied to, or does it just seem that way? And we do that by listening. Listening also produces compassion. One of the things that fascinates me is there's a story in which Jesus is in the synagogue and there's a man with a withered hand. And it's a Sabbath, a Saturday. And so Jesus wants to heal this guy's hand, but the religious leaders are looking for him to work on the Sabbath. And healing would be a work on the Sabbath. Although on another occasion he said to them, if any of you have an animal that falls into a ditch, aren't you going to pull him out on the Sabbath? Well, of course you're going to. And similarly, what about this man right here? He's got a withered hand. And so he heals him. And when he heals him on the Sabbath, these guys get angry. But it's interesting because Jesus, it says, was angry with them because of the hardness of their heart. Then it says he felt compassion for them. Now I'm going to ask you, how many times when you're angry have you felt compassion for the person you're mad at? That doesn't happen to me very often. When I'm angry, it flushes out all compassion. And that's why listening is so important. The more compassion we have for the other person's point of view, the more it will moderate our anger. So we need to learn to listen. Secondly, we need to limit our speech. And that's kind of the flip side of the coin there, isn't it? There are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise. I really like this next one. Even a fool is thought wise if he keeps silent, and discerning if he holds his tongue. All you got to do for people to think you're wise is not say anything. Isn't that the truth? When you're at a committee meeting or a group meeting, and there's one guy, he just kind of listens, you're thinking, man, that guy, he's got something, he's thinking deep. And then, unfortunately, when we open our mouths, all question about our wisdom is immediately eliminated. And that's the point, you know. If we can learn to limit our speech and try to gain more information, but when we're angry, we don't listen. We don't limit our speech. We tend to just let it all go. We let it all rip. And I like this guy because that's one child that will never have hearing issues. And I think it's interesting he has one mouth and two ears, as do we all. And I think there's a lesson to be learned there, which is obviously you've heard it before. You know, we should be listening twice as much as we talk. And I think to do so will help us moderate our anger. And then third, look for God. I really like this. The anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God, the rightness of God. And we need to consider God in the situation. God's anger is perfect. My anger is imperfect. Even when it's justified, it's imperfect. God never gets mad at a perceived wrong. I often get mad at a perceived wrong. There is no 80-20 rule with God. Whatever happened triggered his anger. God doesn't get mad because he's dealing with unprocessed anger that people have disrespect or sins people committed back in past centuries. You know, he's not dealing. When you do something wrong, he doesn't vent all the anger that he has towards people in the past that did wrong things on you. You know, fortunately for us, he vented it all on the cross. You know, all the anger he had towards us, he poured it out on Jesus there. But in this instance, you know, the rightness of God. And God gets mad only at real and not perceived wrongs. So, what should we get mad about? There's a lot of things we should get mad about. You know, we should get mad about killing of unborn children and racism, and religious leaders abusing their followers and starving and sick orphans. I mean, there should be things that stir up anger. You know, I think about mothers against drunk drivers, right? This was because a mother's daughter was killed by a drunk driver, and she got angry and mobilized all these mothers to kind of try to pass legislation to protect the innocent from people who were driving while intoxicated. Many of the universities and hospitals that we have in our country and around the world were built by angry people. They were angry about injustice and illness, and they wanted to correct it. They wanted to right this wrong. But we as Christians find ourselves oftentimes getting mad about things that are stupid. You know, we're getting really angry fighting about political differences or religious differences with people that maybe their particular theology is a little bit different than our theology, and we need that. So let me give you some coaching tips. First, learn, listen, and seek to understand. Understand and then be understood. Understand and then be understood. Determine if the wrong is real or perceived. Avoid acting on your initial impulse. 99% of the time, if you act on your initial impulse, you will be wrong, and you will regret it. I got an email once from someone. I didn't even know her. She was a kind of a low-level editor at one of the publishing houses I've written for, and she had meant it to go to someone else, and it said, well, at least you won't have to be dealing with Bill anymore. And so I hit reply, and I sent it back to her, and I said, oops, I think you meant this to go to someone else. Now, the good news is I was trying to get the publisher to let me make another change in the book because I found what I thought was a weakness, and they were unwilling to let me do that because the book was too far along in production. But about 5 minutes after I sent that email back to that editor, I had the big editor, the main editor, the acquisition editor, who's like right below the publisher, call me on the phone and was just really giving me all these apologies and stuff. And I said, it's no big deal to me, you know, man. I mean, I've written things before that I don't put the address. When I'm writing an angry email, I never put the address on there because I don't intend to send it. But I could have. And I said, I understand that. I said, but you know, it would really make me, you know, whatever hurt I have would all be washed away. I could just make that one change in the book. So it actually worked out to my advantage. But that's an example of, you know, she should have thought before she sent. She should have thought before she hit that send button. And I think we need to be very careful how that we don't act on our initial impulse. Allow God to right the wrong. You know, when Jesus was hanging on the cross, Peter says, while being reviled, he didn't revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And sometimes what we need to do is we just need to back off and let God handle it. We need to back off and let God handle the situation. So learn to listen, limit your speech, and then look for God. And now I'm going to give you an illustration to prove you can do it. Because some of you guys that have real issues managing your anger are going, yeah, right, thanks, Bill. This really kind of solved the problem for me. So let me give you an illustration that will prove you're able to do it. When I was growing up in Roswell, as a boy, I actually liked to light fires. I was literally, I was a pyromaniac as a boy. And I actually surveyed the men. I don't know if the survey's in this book or one of my others, but I surveyed my men that I send my blog to, and I said, how many of you as boys lit fire for the fun of it without adult supervision? And about 75% said they did. How many of you guys as boys lit fires without adult? See, there you go. About 75% of us did that. I enjoyed it. I really actually enjoyed doing it. We lived in Roswell, and across the street from our home was a vacant lot, and One night, someone with a big truck dumped a whole bunch of junk in this vacant lot. I don't mean a pickup load. I mean a truckload. My dad was so mad. He called the police, the sanitation department. No one would do anything. So one day when they were all gone, I think I was about 7 years old, I went out in the garage and I got a 5-gallon can of gas. I walked across the street. I doused this whole thing with gasoline, threw a match in it, ran inside and called the fire department. Sure enough, in a few minutes, fire department comes racing down the street. All the neighbors come out, you know, like there's a parade or something to see what's going on. They hook up their hoses and they start, you know, putting out the fire. And when finally the flames have submitted to the water and the smoke has turned to steam, I approach one of the firemen, a little boy, freckle face. How you think it got started? He looked down at me and said, well, I don't know, son, it's probably spontaneous combustion. And I said, spontaneous combustion. And I was walking away thinking, so that's what gas in a match is, spontaneous combustion. I learned a whole new vocabulary word. I'll tell you what, though, happened, though, about a week later, the city sent someone out and they cleaned that mess up. My dad was very happy and never even know why they did it. I knew. That wasn't the sort of a thing as, boy, I confessed to my dad either. I mean, I just didn't feel that was information he needed to possess, right? But all of that was kind of preparatory for one I was excited about, because we had a long house with a fence around the backyard and there's an alley behind it for sanitation. And it's down by that fence that the gas meter was located. And also where these tumbleweeds would grow. You ever seen Texas tumbleweeds, New Mexico tumbleweeds? These suckers get this big. I'm serious. They're as big as Mini Coopers. These are big tumbleweeds. And when they dry out, they are really flammable. And so one summer, I was going to build a really big fire right where the tumbleweeds were all around that gas meter, and I thought, maybe if I'm lucky, it'll blow up. Now, I didn't know a whole lot about gas and explosions. I just knew that thing could be fun. And so I got some paper, and I stuffed it underneath the tumbleweeds, and I lit it. And I was stunned how fast that thing, it just was like, whoof, it literally took off as a fire faster than the gasoline. It just shot up over the fence. It just, woo. I didn't know my mom was inside doing the dishes at the kitchen sink where there's a window looking out. She saw this, man. She went nuts. She ran out that door screaming and yelling, turned on the spigot to the faucet, grabbed the hose and ran over and started dousing my fire. My fire. I had been looking forward to building that fire for a month or two. I wanted to see what would happen. She was so mad. She was yelling at me, swearing at me, putting out that, you had killed us, going on, saying all these really unkind things to me. Meanwhile, I'm getting madder and madder that she's, you know, look, if she'd have just come out and put out the fire and said, son, boys will be, you know, show me a little respect. You know, like, boys will be boys, and I know you like to start fires, but son, that's the gas meter. If that there's a leak there or something and that thing catches on fire, it could blow up, burn down our house, and, you know, who knows how much damage. She didn't do that. She was so disrespectful to me. She grabbed me by the hand and started dragging me across the yard while I'm fighting back, trying to get away from her, and pulls me up the steps into the kitchen. And she said, I'm going to give you a spanking. Well, big deal. My mom's going to spank me. That's scary. So I said, oh, Mom, please, right here, let me have it. Come on, Mom, I want a spanking. Please, give me a spanking. It was about that moment I heard a noise behind me. You know what it was. It was the man that lived in our house. The man who grew up as a farmer milking cows and had arms like Popeye. It was the guy that had been a professional boxer. It was a guy that really, really enjoyed hurting people when he got in a fight. It was that man. I turned around and I saw him there, and immediately my heart stopped. I'm surprised it ever started beating again. Terror literally rushed through my entire body. Absolute and complete fear. I could have turned around and seen the angel of death and would not have experienced greater fear than I did in that moment. And he smiles, says, you want a spanking? I'll give you a spanking. You want a spanking, son? I'll give you one. Of course, he didn't have a mic on. Then he starts doing this. Any of you guys had dads that did that? You want a spanking? I'm going to give you a spanking. No, Dad, I don't want a spanking. I don't want a spanking, Dad. I'll never talk to Mom like that again. I'll never build a fire, I promise. Oh, please, Dad, don't spank me. Please, please. He enjoyed my begging. And he gave me a spanking. And I can tell you right now, I never talked to my mom like that again. Now, here's my question for you. If I had known my dad was standing behind me, do you think I might have expressed my anger differently? Yes or no? So there we have it. If we lived with a conscious awareness of God's presence, we would moderate our behavior. If we knew he was literally standing next to us, which he is, we would moderate how we process and express our anger. I mean, you do it at work all the time because you know if you didn't control it, you'd get fired. It's only at home where there is no concern like that that we can let it all hang out, so to speak. So I suggest that we learn to live with an awareness of the presence of Christ. Let's pray together. Father, I want to thank you for your love and your grace and your mercy, for the work you're doing in our lives. I want to pray, Father, you would help us learn to listen, to first understand and then be understood, to limit our speech and to look for you. Give us the grace, Father, to be men who learn how to process and express our anger just as Jesus did. I pray this for Christ's sake. Okay, what I want you guys to do now is just where you're sitting, just turn and form circles of like 4 or 6. And we'll take about 10 minutes for you guys to kind of talk through these discussion questions here, okay? So just, you know, wherever you are, just form little circles. And if you're sitting by yourself, then kind of move closer to a few other guys. And just, you know, kind of talk through those. Now, there's only 4 rules. Rule number 1 is no one does all the talking. Rule number 2 is no one does no talking. Rule number three is no one has all the answers. Because men won't talk if there's an expert there, because we don't want to be sounding stupid. So there's no expert that knows all the answers. And number 4, what's said here stays here. Okay? What's said here stays here. So those are good. No one does all the talking. No one does no talking. No one has all the answers. And what we talk about here, we allow it to stay here. Okay? So, break into your little groups, and I'll let you know when we're going to move on.